both historically and today, where have women existed in the workers' struggle?
Let's have a look. Let's see. What's a good point to start? March the 8th, which, as you know, is now celebrated as International Women's Day. For many years, it was International Working Women's Day. It was actually celebrated its centenary last year, usually sponsored by banks, usually with a whole lot of finger clicks and you go girls and self-esteem workshops. It was rather different. Now, there are various accounts of what occurred, but what people can all agree on, this day led to the downfall of the Tsar in Russia, heralded the beginning of the Russian Revolution. Women of nobility, you know, the little princesses of the time, women of the peasant class and female students had a very large demonstration, possibly a spontaneous one, possibly not one agitated by the Bolsheviks, against the war, the First World War, the extraordinary First World War that took so many lives. And then in the afternoon, it said, they were joined by a large number of female textile workers in what was then Petrograd. They joined them in great number. And so this is the genesis of International Women's Day, or International Working Women's Day, celebrated, or in my view, utterly disrespected on March the 8th. A spontaneous gathering of women protesting two things. War doesn't happen anymore, does it? And protest against worker exploitation, whether that was of the factory workers themselves, women, or the workers who were really soldiers. Remember, a bayonet is a weapon with a worker at both ends. Round about the same time, the great Rosa Luxemburg was one of 150,000 women members of the SDP, and about the same number, probably the same women in Germany, belonged to trade unions. Around about the same time, there was accounts of 300,000 female members of unions. There were meetings of socialist women who were almost always members of trade unions. And one of the reasons that they said that they had to declare themselves as separate from the broader workers' struggle was to position themselves in opposition to the then prominent in the UK and other Western countries, more bourgeois struggle for suffrage. Let's think about Juanita Nielsen, an heiress, I believe, who disappeared in July 1975. Now, she was connected with the Builders Labourers Federation, in my view. And if you can see the documentary, Rocking the Foundations, about the BLF, this is an extraordinary organisation, now more or less characterised and very wrongly as a corrupting and corrupt misogynist organisation of not even idealists, but murderers. And there were a lot of Aboriginal people. There were a huge amount of migrant workers. There was exceptional leaders and members. And they formed connections, as unions should, beyond, as unions must, as trade unions have always strived to. They formed connections beyond the workplace, to the urban area, to other rights. And Nielsen was very much involved in the so-called Green Bans, an attempt to save public housing in Sydney. In 1866, just after black women in the USA were allegedly freed, they formed in Jackson, Mississippi, a large group of women laundresses. They formed a union, and they did strike for higher wages. Did I mention Rose Schneiderman, who coined the phrase bread and roses? The authoress of this phrase came to attention after the Triangle Shirtwaist Factory fire around about the First World War period too, which killed 123 women and 23 men in New York City. She devoted a great deal of her life to bringing to a broader attention the unsafe working conditions under which many people, women and men, laboured. Like many people, perhaps like you, this historic event, which is still remembered and falsely remembered by liberals, I guess, as an example of how far we've come when many more women died in the Rana Plaza factory collapse of textile workers, largely women in Bangladesh. Almost 100 years later, this was recalled. So, I mean, there's so many examples. There's so much reliable data about where women have existed in the workers' struggle and the struggle against the nation state, the struggle against capital as a defining force. So they've always been there. And where are they now? Well, you may as well ask where the struggle is now. We can't compare the major unions we have today of those unions that I've just mentioned. I mean, these were really still, charismatic leadership was needed and what have you, and people were informed by texts and pamphlets, but they weren't informed from the top down. So, yeah, sure, in Australia we see many prominent women represented in unions. The problem is that we don't see many unions genuinely representing their members.
You've described yourself as a Marxist feminist. What does that mean, and what is the relationship between Marxism and feminism?
Again, not going for the tiny questions. Straight to the meat, love. Straight to the meat, Lauren. Or indeed, for our vegan listeners. What do they call it? Satan? Call myself a Marxist feminist? I must have done. You do appear like a young sister who does her research. I guess in the past, to call oneself a feminist or indeed a Marxist was something I elected to do as a provocation. To declare that this is my political identity is something you do to shit people, right? Mark yourself against predominant thought. So it would be more correct to say I am a person informed by Marxist tenets, and or I am a person informed by many feminist texts. I'm not now, nor am I ever likely to let go the knowledge, the rage, the inspiration I've gained from feminist texts. There's still feminist work and feminist theory I admire. But as for calling oneself a feminist in the present, I don't understand the usefulness. When the word feminist appears and is barely challenged, then what's the point of calling oneself a feminist? And when the word feminist has been most visibly identified with those who would wish only for a meritocracy. Liberal feminists talk about equal opportunity. I'm much more interested in an abundance shared by all, not just by those who happen to be marvelous enough to acquire it. So that's not really answering your question. I have called myself a Marxist feminist in the past, maybe just Marxist now for strategic reasons. The relationship between Marxism and feminism, I mean, even just looking in Australia, has a history of great argument. The women who were most prominent in acquiring suffrage were also members of the temperance union. They were also Christian. They're also women in great favour of censorship. They were women in favour of the class system as it was. I see this, well, we shouldn't call it paternalism, should we? Maybe we call it maternalism instead. I see this extending to the present. There's this sort of idea that you could see in a lot of popular liberal women texts, which you see in the newspaper and online and what have you, and we say, well, you know, this particular reality television program is not good for women, and ergo, it should be removed. And I mean, of course, it's not helpful to women. I don't watch, well, not this season anyway, of Married at First Sight or whatever the object currently is of liberal feminist critique. But there are a lot of attacks on cultural goods, just as there were among the temperance suffragettes of the early 20th century, saying, well, you know, the poor women and the poor men, they can't handle this kind of entertainment, unlike us. We see a lot of liberal feminists supporting war. Oh, mad for it they are. I mean, not all the time, but if we look at the defence, for example, of Hillary Clinton's actions as the Secretary of State, there are many liberal feminists who will say that she did exactly the right thing in Libya. I don't think most Libyans agree.
While traditionally Marxism and class-focused ideologies tend to eschew identity politics, do you think there is a place in these movements for a more intersectional view of feminism?
So while it might be true that identity politics or the cult of the individual has been something that is secondary, tertiary to standing shoulder to shoulder with one's comrades, that doesn't mean that the fact of different cultural identities has been completely eroded. The other thing that I wanted to say is that identity politics may share some characteristics but is not identical with intersectionalism. Intersectionalism does not necessarily, I mean, in its popular iteration, you know, a lot of people believe that intersectionalism is people telling their individual stories and we will all be inspired by these individual stories. And another misapprehension of intersectionalism is that it's entirely feminist. Now, while Kimberlé Crenshaw was certainly a feminist and approached it from that standpoint in her famous paper about, you know, the intersections that women in particular might find themselves at, the development of intersectionalism or intersectionality or whatever you want to call it comes from critical race theory. So in short, as I understand it, and I have been attempting to understand intersectional texts for these last few years to see what value they have for us, well, the idea is that, no, so, you know, say a woman or a man, so a woman of colour with a disability who is also impoverished, that she experiences a kind of oppression which is not just trebled in that instance, but a kind of oppression that is different in nature, which creates a sort of paralysis that, say, a white, well-to-do woman feminist wouldn't. That she finds herself at not just intersections, but at a sort of a hub which genuinely changes, not just amplifies, but changes the nature of oppression. So that insight for me is a good one. How it can work within Marxism, just as a lot of the identity realizations, the sexual liberation, the gay lib, the second wave feminism worked within the new left, I guess, that Marxism takes on these things and in its actions and its thinking understands these new insights. But for me, intersectionalism is not a plan for action. It's an extraordinary description. And I mean, I may have said in the past quite dismissive things of it. I now see that it describes a depth, not just of individual experience, but of large group experiences where the nature of oppression changes very much. Identity politics is something that is distinct from intersectionality. That's something I'm now able to say. The fear that I have of intersectionality, which is something that works well in some cases in you know, bourgeois departments. You know, the UN has taken on some of the stuff and acknowledges that there is a kind of, you know, experience of extreme paralysis and oppression that certain sorts of people face, and that must be addressed, and, you know, the Human Rights Commission and what have you. So it is useful in academia. It's useful in its bourgeois sociological applications in terms of it being a blueprint for social change. I don't think that it is. It can be something that informs people, whether they're working within the bourgeois state or within private enterprise, and it provides a good reminder of things as they are. What it does not provide is an understanding of things as they might be. So I would say march here in Melbourne on May 9, not to the drum of the ACTU and its partner organisation, the ALP, but to those much older rhythms, to that truer reality that has been permitted to evolve under our liberal capitalist economy, which is solidarity for all workers. A true socialist understanding is that we are all workers for capitalism. Whether we're unemployed or underemployed people, well, we work for capitalism to keep other people's wages low. This includes, of course, contract workers, the self-employed, the casual, and, of course, those who care for others who are performing labour or cannot perform labour anymore. And I would say also much more idealistically, if we think about a world, if we dare imagine a world beyond capitalism, we'd all be workers, or at least we'd all be productive, because that seems to me to be a natural human inclination, imagining things to do, erecting them in our imagination, and then making them and doing them. May 9 could be a moment of hope in Melbourne, and not because our union officials say it is a moment for hope, glorious hope, and not because they offer us some promise that they'll represent us, but because May Day is an opportunity for us to represent ourselves and also to find each other and perhaps do some of that work of talking to other workers. And that's something that so many of us now, alone in our cubicles or under surveillance or driving our Ubers or being on rotating shifts where we don't get to talk to our neighbours. And that's the old slogan of the Paris riot, talk to your neighbour. This is an opportunity to talk to our neighbour where we get to see each other and see what is different and what is similar about our experience. So, yeah, let's march here in Melbourne on May 9 from 10 a.m. at Trades Hall. Actually, May Day, but hey, close to the 50th anniversary of the Paris riots and just a few days after the 200th anniversary of the birth of Karl Marx, who, no, I don't think he's a god. I just think he's a bloke that spent more time than anybody writing down the effects of the movement of capital in our lives. I'll see you on May 9.